This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of July, and this week, multimillionaire money manager Jeffrey Epstein is in jail. He was arrested last Friday after getting off his private jet from Paris, indicted for child sex trafficking. The federal government alleges he oversaw a scheme to bring underage girls, teenaged about 15, to his homes in New York and Florida for sex. Of course, this isn't just a crime story. Epstein had high-profile associates from the worlds of business, entertainment, and both sides of the political aisle. And when Epstein first faced legal trouble over these allegations over a decade ago, he seemed to get the plea deal of the century, spending just a year in county jail and allowed out 6 days a week for work release. President Trump's labor secretary, Alex Acosta, had been the United States attorney who cut that deal, and this Friday he announced he will resign due to the compounding criticism for letting Epstein off so easy. Bill Clinton flew on Epstein's plane 27 times, sometimes without Secret Service present, and while Donald Trump fell out with Epstein before Epstein's public disgrace, they used to like each other. Trump spoke approvingly in 2002 about his and Epstein's shared taste for women on the young side. One thing everything is wondering is what could be on tapes and recordings that federal agents found in Epstein's New York home. We'll discuss that in a moment, and later in today's show, we'll look at the Trump administration's losing effort to ask about citizenship on the 2020 census and about litigation that threatens the Affordable Care Act. We'll also talk about the left-right consensus that's pushing the Federal Reserve to focus more on boosting employment. Cardiff Garcia from Planet Money will join us to discuss the Fed critique that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Larry Kudlow agree about. But now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Helene Olin of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hey.
Hi, Josh.
Let's start with Epstein. Helene, what lessons do you take from his arrest?
Oh, there's a lot of lessons, right? There's always, you know, why a scandal becomes a scandal. And I think on one level, this is fairly obvious. This is grotesque and disgusting. But I think it's also because this has been going on for a decade, and it sort of gets at the lies that are at the heart of our society. We've had this society where we've been sort of dominated by a meritocracy for the past several decades, this idea that we're sort of ruled by the best and the brightest, and that these people are harder working and that they're more deserving, and that, you know, the poor are the poor because they're a bunch of slackers who are not disciplined at all, and they give in to, cheap luxuries right away. And in fact, what this scandal shows is that this is all ridiculous. You know, this is a scandal about giving in to your absolute worst impulses. It appears that there are people on both sides of the aisle who are very wealthy who are somehow implicated in this. And what makes it even more astonishing is even after Epstein had his sweetheart deal in jail for barely a year in Florida, where he was on, you know, partial work release, by the way, every day picked up by his chauffeured limousine, people, celebrities were still willing to hang out with him. People still came to his parties, and charities literally lined up like pigs at the trough to take his money.
Rich, there have been some conspiracy theories over the last few years, sort of positing wild ideas about sex rings among the elite and the steps taken to protect them. I mean, Pizzagate, the claim about a child sex ring being run out of a pizza parlor basement, which obviously is complete nonsense, has gained some purchase. It seems like this is an actual story about a sex ring among the elite that was protected by forces very high within the government. I think a question a lot of people are asking is why?
Yeah, well, it's disgusting. I think Acosta botched the case. I don't think he did it for any nefarious conspiratorial reasons. I think part of the explanation is that his team just seemed to be intimidated and cowed and felt harassed by the very aggressive top-flight legal representation that Jeffrey Epstein had, and that's not the way to react in such a circumstance. And I think the hardest question for Acosta to answer, he never couldn't adequately, is just why not wait and gather more evidence and go to trial and really nail him? And it's impossible to avoid the conclusion that if every criminal defendant in the country had Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz as their defense lawyers, all of them would be much better off. And that's just kind of an inherent equity of the system, inequity in our system and our world. And I don't think people focused enough yet on what might have been the very worst aspect of the deal Acosta cut with Epstein, which may be that it lets him get off the hook on the SDNY prosecution as well on double jeopardy grounds.
Yeah, I spoke with Ken White on our sister show, All the President's Lawyers, on Wednesday, and he seems to think the SDNY is probably on solid ground to be prosecuting Epstein here, that the deal was in certain ways limited enough to the Southern District of Florida that it does allow the Southern District of New York to bring a prosecution in New York over conduct, much of which occurred in New York. But I think, Rich, you're certainly right that that's something that's going to be litigated, and Acosta did create some weaknesses there. Helene, on the subject of how much this tells us about our society, I feel like often it's hard to draw lessons from the most egregious cases because the most egregious cases are, by definition, unusual. And there are a lot of things that are really mysterious about Epstein. I mean, he was clearly very well connected. Nobody seems to fully understand why. And related to that, nobody seems to fully understand how he got so wealthy. I mean, Epstein, you know, you talk about the rule of the meritocracy. Epstein is not somebody who inherited his wealth. He somehow made this immense amount of money. But it's a mystery that people have been talking about on and around Wall Street. Basically, you know, if he was really some brilliant money manager, why can we only find one of his clients? Why is nobody on the other side of trades with him? People are trying to figure out, you know, how it is that Epstein ever became so wealthy and powerful in the first place.
I absolutely agree. I mean, what I would say to your first point is that scandals become scandals because they say things about our society. I mean, there's awful things happening every day. So you always have to ask when something blows up as a story, why are we so fascinated by it? And I think one of the reasons is the mysteriousness of Epstein. There, as you put it, there is nobody who can, barely anybody who seems to recall him ever having much of a presence on Wall Street. Yet he, you know, he doesn't seem to have really worked. Yet at the same time, he seems to have all this money. So the question is where does it come from? Why hasn't anybody been asking questions about it for the past several decades? And, you know, what does it mean that he has all of this money? And nobody even was really able to reckon with this yet.
Yeah, and Rich, to Helene's note about his persistent access to society even after the first round of legal trouble that he got into, Helene surfaced an article from the Daily Beast in 2011 about Epstein throwing a party and Katie Couric and George Stephanopoulos and Chelsea Handler and various other notables showing up to that. And I just find this stuff very strange in retrospect because obviously we learned a lot in the intervening years about precisely what Epstein had been up to and terrible details that drew a lot of attention. But the broad strokes of what he had done were known as of 2008, that he had an apparatus set up to sexually abuse minors. I find it surprising in retrospect that he was able to maintain even the diminished position in society that he did for so long.
Yeah, we've talked about this before in various Me Too cases and even involving Michael Jackson, the phenomenon of quote-unquote everyone knowing. And you know, that's sort of by word of mouth and suspicion and kind of rumors that everyone sort of believes, but there's not hard evidence of. This is a case where the guy was a registered sex offender. And, you know, one of Acosta's 3 points in favor of the way he handled it is he got him to register. So everyone would know that he's a sexual predator, and it had almost zero effect on his social standing. So this does not speak well of our elite and the people who continue to hobnob with him and just look past this. And it is a mystery, as you guys are just discussing, how he got his money. But it seems as though perhaps an element of it was just pretending that you were rich, you know, and then you get to spend a lot of time with actual rich and influential people, and they actually might make it easier for you to actually get rich or richer than you were before you started pretending to be rich. So it's a distressing story about an element of our elite. I wouldn't say this defines everyone who's upper income or the upper middle class, who most of whom do well because they exhibit certain virtues, certain bourgeois virtues of self-discipline and not indulging bizarre appetites. But this is a story with a lot of disgusting implications.
Can I say something here? I mean, I want to say, I think we have this fascination with celebrity in our culture. And celebrity sort of, you know, trumps celebrity. I mean, people hung out with Epstein in part because, as awful as this sounds, he was a celebrity. And I think you can't dismiss that part of it. And the other thing I will say is while it's not clear he was a billionaire, it's pretty clear by 20 years ago he's probably worth at least $100 million and probably more. I mean, he did own his home. He did have these private planes. I mean, he did get this money and he did get it from somewhere. The question is where?
Yeah, he has this like $70 million home in Manhattan and a private island in the U.S. Virgin Islands that's about 60 acres. Rich, what have you been watching this week?
Joe Biden, and I haven't been on since the famous debate and the school busing showdown with Kamala Harris. He apologized about 4 weeks after the fact for his original remarks about working with segregationists being a model for how Washington should work, which to me was a sign of weakness. And I just wonder if he's going to get chased into sort of serial apologies throughout this process that'll make him look weak. On the other hand, in an interview with CNN, he kind of doubled down on his more moderate orientation, at least relative to the rest of the field, on healthcare and various economic proposals. But it does seem that the race has kind of settled in now where he's not as formidable a front runner as he was looking when he first announced. And he's definitely the leader of the pack, but it's easier to squint and see him as part of a top tier pack rather than running away with it.
Helene, do you think his position looks better or worse than it did when we spoke 2 weeks ago after the debate? We did get a poll from NBC News that had him with – it was NBC's first primary poll. It showed him in the mid-20s with a solid lead, unlike some other polls that had showed him almost tied with Kamala Harris, and showed Harris all the way down at 13% with Warren being the second candidate behind him. So it's, you know, if you compared it to a month ago, you would say it was a bad poll for Biden. But if you compare it to 2 weeks ago, you might say it was a good poll for him.
Right. I mean, I think part of this, you know, story is the slow rise of Warren. But what I would say about Biden is that he sort of came into the race as this, you know, perceived front runner who people actually hadn't seen in a couple of years. And as they're getting to see him, some of the support is falling off, which actually isn't much of a surprise. The same thing is frankly happening with Bernie Sanders as well, that the more you see them, the more you remember things maybe you didn't like or that you didn't know about. How this is going to shake out, I don't know. I mean, the Tom Steyer entry into the race has kind of thrown another wrench into everything.
And, you know, does that matter?
I think a little bit. He spent already over $1 million on ads this week. The race had been sorting out into, you know, basically a top tier. And that top tier was Biden, Warren, Harris, and Sanders. And not in that order, by the way, because I think it goes all over the place, with maybe Buttigieg in the fifth position, but seeming to really be falling behind at this point. If somebody comes in and starts throwing around millions of dollars, I'd be really surprised to see if it didn't have some impact. I'm not saying it'll definitely push Steyer's support. I'm not positive that's going to be it. But it's definitely going to push things in ways that maybe nobody is thinking about. And I think it's kind of disturbing that somebody can just sort of enter like that and have this happen. I mean, it seems almost ill-disciplined and, you know, not quite right. And I think this is one of the things people are complaining about so much in our society, this idea that these multimillionaires and billionaires are just sort of coming in and throwing around their weight. That's not what happens in a democracy.
See, I feel differently about this, which is to say, and we will, you know, one of us will be right about this within a few weeks. I think there's no appetite for Tom Steyer in this race, and I think he can spend as much money on ads as he wants, and it's not going to get him anywhere. And I think it's the same reason that Howard Schultz seems to have backed away from his desire to mount an independent bid. I think just because you're a rich guy with a bunch of money to spend on ads, that doesn't necessarily mean you'll catch on, especially when you are not really where the energy is within the electorate. I think I can think of some rich business people who could enter a presidential race and have an interesting effect. I think if Mark Cuban ran for president as a third-party candidate, I think that would matter a great deal in the general election. But I think Howard Schultz was a non-factor, and my guess is that Steyer is also going to be a non-factor. I don't know, Rich, what do you make of the Steyer announcement?
That would be my take. You know, they're just – money's not enough. You have to have various qualities, you know, message, a brand, and a performative ability as a politician. And one thing that made Trump different is he was not just wealthy, but he actually didn't spend that much in his campaign in the scheme of things. But he had those other three things, the message, the brand, and the performative ability. And I don't see that with Tom Steyer.
I think by definition, you just can't dismiss that amount of money being pushed into the primary at this point.
Rich, I know you wrote about Joe Biden's money this week.
Yeah, Joe Biden has he'd been different than a lot of prominent national politicians in his lack of wealth, but he made up for that in the first 2 years after the end of the Obama administration, when he made about $15 million, the way all famous politicians do with book deals and speaking gigs. And Biden is not the most populist candidate in this field. Obviously, one of the remarks that got him a little hot water at that fundraiser where he talked about working with segregationists when he said there's nothing wrong with being rich and we're not going to change anyone's lifestyle. But that was one rich guy talking to a room full of other rich guys.
Yeah, Helene, when I look at this, I see a couple of things. I mean, one is obviously middle-class Joe has been a key part of his branding. And while his family income, while he was a senator, was high by national standards, he was making about $400,000 a year at the end between him and his wife. That was a low income by the standards of the United States Senate. He did not have massive personal wealth. Now he clearly does. The other thing is how he's made this money. And I sort of look at it in two chunks. I don't care about these people getting book deals. I think a book deal means you basically get a few dollars from each of hundreds of thousands of consumers who are interested in reading a book or books that you have to write. I don't think that creates an actual or apparent conflict of interest. I think that's, you know, that's a legitimate sort of spoils of becoming a prominent person who people are interested in hearing from. What bothers me are speaking fees, because these come in chunks of, you know, well over $100,000 from individual institutions. And I think they make politicians mindful of how moneyed institutions are going to feel about them when they're out of office. If you want to be able to go on the speaking circuit and collect a lot of money for not very much work, you need to be the sort of person that they're going to be interested in bringing in to give speeches. And so I think that is a corrupting influence. I think Hillary Clinton correctly got a lot of flack over that. And I think the practice of other presidents who leave office, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, going all the way back to Ronald Reagan, who do that speaking circuit thing, I think that's a real problem.
I actually think both are real problems. As the person here who's probably published the most books, I know something about the publishing industry, and I can tell you these are massive. These are, you know, these aren't like small little publishing houses. These are massive media conglomerates throwing around millions of dollars that they might well not be earning back. And you've got to start asking why. And the question becomes, who's trying to buy influence there again, right?
I just want to touch briefly on something that I think got a little bit overlooked this week, which is the White House backed off an effort to prohibit rebate payments between drug makers and pharmacy benefit managers that oversee prescription drug plans that people are on. This sounds technical. It's one of several policies that the Trump administration has flirted with that would aim to constrain the prices of prescription drugs, which is something that President Trump has talked a lot about on the stump. But every time he seems to try to do something on this, he ends up running into roadblocks. In this instance, his Health and Human Services Secretary, Alex Azar, was a big proponent of this plan, but also had a lot of opposition within the administration. Some people were saying that they thought that it was actually going to push drug prices up if they did this. Rich, this feels to me like one of many examples of an area where the president has a populist instinct, but he lacks the policy chops to actually figure out how to turn those instincts into policy and then defend and implement it. And then he's influenced by interests all around in his administration that may have good points or maybe not, but that basically defend the status quo, which he has complained about, where Americans pay much higher prices for various aspects of healthcare, including prescription drugs, than they would in other countries.
I think that's right. I think this is a little bit more a defensible example of having the instinct and not having the policy, because it's so complicated. Just this question of rebates, it's just such seems like such a screwy system where the drug companies pay rebates to these pharmacy benefit managers who get the drugs then on lists of insurance plans and then negotiate discounts for those plans, including Medicare. So one of the concerns here was that if you stop the rebates, that the savings wouldn't be passed on to consumers. The drug companies would just pocket them. And the cost for Medicare beneficiaries would go up, which it's not a great thing to have happen when you're going into a tough election cycle in 2020. And I'm a huge fan of the pharmaceutical industry. I think drugs are just medical drugs have just work everyday miracles in people's lives. But it just raises the question, why can't you just have a price for this stuff, you know, like anything else? But it's just another element of our healthcare system that is incredibly complex and opaque, not just to consumers, but to a lot of people who follow the policy.
Yeah, I mean, Helene, that point Rich gets at there, I think, is a correct instinct that the president has here, which is that it seems like it's a problem when nobody can figure out what anything costs, that's the sort of system where things end up getting really expensive because people can't figure out what they're paying for.
The healthcare system really needs a massive overhaul. And I think we're all kind of flummoxed as to how that is going to happen. But I think what we can say is these little small bore things that somebody thinks are going to be easy to accomplish are not going to be easy to accomplish. Even changing something like this, it turns out to have hit, you know, tons of roadblocks, huge numbers of vested interests, and it didn't happen. And I think that then begs the question of what are we going to do about healthcare in this country?
Let's take a quick break. We'll actually come back. We'll talk more about healthcare with Nick Bagley from the University of Michigan School of Law, who will talk with us about litigation that threatens the entire Affordable Care Act. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Helene Olin of The Washington Post. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Helene Olin, columnist at The Washington Post. There will not be a question about citizenship on the 2020 U.S. Census, which is a major disappointment to the president and his supporters. The Commerce Department, which oversees the census, had sought to add the question, and like many executive actions the president has taken, this drew lawsuits. About 2 weeks ago, a divided Supreme Court ruled the administration couldn't put the question on the census, at least not yet. Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the controlling opinion, endorsed the idea that the administration had broad latitude to add questions like this, but to do so, they have to follow the Administrative Procedure Act, which requires the administration to explain why they're making a change like this. And he found they didn't, because the explanation they offered, that the question was necessary to ensure compliance with the Voting Rights Act, was obviously a lie. After the ruling, the Commerce and Justice Department said they'd go ahead and print the census forms with no citizenship question. The president didn't like that. He said on Twitter he would be working on finding a way to ask the question on the census after all, which confused the government's own lawyers litigating the case and the judge overseeing one of the relevant cases. Then this Friday, the president backed down. He said he was confident that he could ultimately win in the courts, but there just wasn't enough time to do that and get the forms printed and actually conduct the census. So he'd have to find another way to gather the data that he wants. To discuss how we got here on the census and also to look at litigation threatening the Affordable Care Act, we're joined now by Nick Bagley. Nick is a professor at the University of Michigan School of Law, and he's a contributor to The Incidental Economist, a health policy blog. Hey, Nick.
Hi, Josh.
Am I right to understand this census case outcome as a situation where the Trump administration was done in solely by its own incompetence, that the courts would have allowed them to do what they wanted here if essentially they'd filled out the paperwork right?
Nope, that's exactly what the Supreme Court held. It said, look, there are all sorts of conceivable good or at least admissible reasons why it is that you might want to add a citizenship question. All you needed to do was cross your T's and dot your I's. And instead, you cooked up a rationale that frankly, didn't even pass the laugh test. It was a pretext for your real justifications, and you got to do better than that.
Rich, when I look at this, I'm just wondering how Wilbur Ross still has his job as Commerce Secretary. I mean, the president ultimately endorsed the view that Nick just described there in his press conference in the Rose Garden on Friday, basically saying, you know, we had the legal right, we could have done it here, but we don't have time. I mean, they did have time. They had 2 years. They just did the wrong things in that period. Isn't that on Wilbur Ross and the Commerce Department screwing that up?
Well, we don't know what guidance he was taking from above, which might be saving grace if you're Wilbur Ross. But this, you know, this is completely botched. I cannot claim to have been in the inside of this process at all, but I know some people who are in the orbit of this question at the beginning, and we're saying, let's just ask it on the general survey, because then you can use some of the post-enumeration analysis to see, you know, if you're missing people, and you can have a debate over, you know, districts being drawn too much on the basis of people who are non-citizens, you know, which you might disagree with all that and think that's something we don't need to do, but it would, you know, be honest, it's reasonable, and instead they came up with this cockamamie explanation that didn't make any sense on the face of it, and that people who were, as I say, part of this process knew was completely pretextual and made up, and then they fought a high-profile court battle over it, and lost.
What Rich is referencing there is what the president described on Thursday as why he thought the citizenship question was important, which is basically in an effort to allow states to draw districts for state legislatures and such, not based on how many people live within the districts, but how many eligible voters live within the districts. So you wouldn't have to count the non-citizens. You wouldn't have to count children, various other people who are not eligible to vote. Nick, do you have any sense of where the administration's fortunes are on that? I mean, the Supreme Court hasn't ruled either way on whether you're even allowed to draw districts like that. The president was sort of alluding to the idea that they'd get together with the Social Security Administration and various other agencies and try to come up with estimates of how many non-citizens there are in the country and try to use that as the basis for districting.
What I'll say is it's not totally clear whether they're going to be able to manage to do that without the census data. Even if they have the census data, they're going to have to come up with rationales probably at the state level for doing so. Whether that'll pass muster in the Supreme Court is anybody's guess, and a lot could turn on this coming election and the composition of the Supreme Court going forward.
Helene, at the press conference, well, I shouldn't call it a press conference. They didn't take any questions. But at the press availability where the president spoke with the attorney general on Thursday, the attorney general sort of criticized the media for suggesting that the president might try to ignore this court ruling and go ahead and lawlessly ask the question on the census anyway, and saying they were absolutely not going to do that. Now, it was the president himself who had floated that idea. But it does seem, again, like this is an example where the system has worked, that basically there was a law, the administration didn't follow it. There were consequences for that. Courts handed down those consequences, and the administration has followed what the courts told them to do.
I'd like to put it that Trump loses and wins in this one. He loses because, obviously, he lost, right? The question is not going to be on the census at this point. He wins, though, because Trump governs in chaos, and he's not like a traditional politician this way. He's actually more about results than process. And when I say results, I mean result he can live with. And the result he can live with here is actually kind of a good outcome for him in a really sick way, which is there's a lot of confusion now over the census. Most people are not as engaged with this as us on this panel, right? And, you know, the question is how many people who are not citizens at this point are going to be eagerly signing up to fill out their census papers, and which is something of a problem every 10 years, even in the best of circumstances. And this is definitively not the best of circumstances. Trump is targeting undocumented migrant workers right now significantly. There might be raids this weekend, in fact. I wouldn't be surprised if people didn't want to, you know, fill out their census papers for fear that they would be contacted in some ways if they are here and undocumented. And the chances are incredible we're going to have a significant undercount at this point, regardless of whether the citizenship question is on the census or not.
And I should add to that, Josh, too, you can also you can look at the Supreme Court decision as a roadmap for adding the question for 2030. So, yeah, you lost the battle today, but you may very well win the next war, depending on, again, who the president is when we get to the next decennial census.
But is that necessarily a bad legal outcome? I mean, why shouldn't the president be legally able to ask a question like this if he, you know, if he follows the proper administrative procedures to put the question on the census? They have asked about citizenship before, and they ask about it now on various surveys that are not universal, like the American Community Survey every year.
Yeah, I think the concern is that it is about the real motivations for asking the question, that there is, you know, lots of statements made about, you know, wanting to get an accurate count for this reason or that. But at the end of the day, the real concern on the left is that we all know why these citizenship questions are being asked, and it's to disadvantage Democrats and advantage Republicans going forward. And I think a lot of people are squeamish about using the executive's authority here to put a thumb on the scales in favor of one party or another.
Yeah, I just think it's a totally legitimate question to ask, and it's been asked in prior surveys. It's asked in smaller surveys now, and it's just important to getting a true demographic picture of what the state of the country is, which is the purpose of the census. Now, what you do with that data, I think, is an entirely legitimate debate, but I don't see any problem with having it actually asked as part of the general survey.
Let's talk about the Affordable Care Act. People will remember the 2012 Supreme Court decision in NFIB versus Sebelius, where the Affordable Care Act individual mandate survived as a tax. Chief Justice Roberts was not willing to say that Congress could just order people to buy health insurance, but he said they could impose a tax on people who didn't buy health insurance. Then there was the 2017 tax law, which reduced the penalty for violating the mandate to buy insurance to zero. As a result, a number of conservative states sued again, trying to get the Affordable Care Act thrown out, saying the individual mandate maybe used to be a tax, but it obviously can't be a tax anymore when the amount collected under that tax is zero. As such, they argue the mandate has now become unconstitutional. And that if the mandate is struck down, so must the entire Affordable Care Act be struck down, since the law's architects had argued the mandate was very central to the functioning of the law. This argument was not well received by legal scholars, even by conservative legal scholars who had been involved in previous challenges to the health law. But a district court judge did buy the argument, issuing an order last year to strike down the entire law. That order was put on hold pending appeal, and this week a three-judge panel in New Orleans heard appeal arguments. Nick, I gather you think those arguments didn't go so well.
Yeah, no, it was a tough day for the defenders of the Affordable Care Act. I think that's safe to say. So there were three judges on the panel. There was a Democrat-appointed judge and two Republican-appointed judges. The Democratic-appointed judge didn't ask any questions. And the two Republicans, boy, they seemed like they had it in for the Affordable Care Act. In their view, the mandate lives on and, in fact, issues a coercive command to people, even though it's backed up by a $0 penalty. And as such, it's unconstitutional. And they were also, they seemed at least to entertain the possibility that that would drag the entire rest of the Affordable Care Act down with it. The questions they asked to the blue states that are in the case defending the Affordable Care Act were quite pointed and at times quite hostile. And they asked, frankly, softballs to the state of Texas and the red state challengers to the act.
So I spoke this morning with Jonathan Adler, who we've had on this show in the past. He's a professor at Case Western Law, and he's been on the other side from you on some of these challenges. But he and you have been on the same side of this one, arguing that this is a very bad argument for throwing out the law. And he thinks people have been overreading this oral argument a little bit, sort of jumping too much to a conclusion about how the judges are likely to feel about the underlying legal questions and how they're likely to rule. I know that there's been a little bit of divide in expert opinion about how to read this this oral argument. So what is the case for not panicking about what these judges said?
Yeah, the case for not panicking is that it's always hazardous to read too much into oral arguments. Sometimes judges ask questions in order to play devil's advocate. Sometimes they don't voice all the concerns they may have about a litigant's case. And sometimes they may write a decision that at the time, I mean, they may come to a different conclusion once they look at the papers more closely. And to that extent, I think Jonathan is right. I don't think he'd disagree with me in saying that the tone of the argument was a surprise. I think a lot of people thought that the judges on the Fifth Circuit would laugh this one out of court, would give the challengers to the Affordable Care Act a really hard time. And we didn't see that. Now, whether that's indicative of their eventual decision, you know, it's really hard to say. But I think it's at least telling, and we should notice that this case has maybe more legs than a lot of folk, including me, thought it had.
Yeah, Rich, I think there's been a little bit of surprise how far this has gotten, and Republicans are almost maybe the dog that caught the car here. If you throw out the entire Affordable Care Act, and this is something that was discussed extensively in the oral argument, is if your claim is, well, you lose the individual mandate, we have to throw the whole law out because it's so interconnected and, you know, the regulations don't work like they were supposed to if you don't have the mandate. But there's a lot of other stuff in the law, like menu calorie labeling requirements, changes to the Medicare prescription drug benefit that reduce the amount that seniors pay for their drugs. If you throw out the entire law, you lose a lot of things that people don't even really think of as Obamacare. I don't think Republicans have really prepared for that political eventuality of what they have to do if people lose a lot of things that are very remote from the mandate itself that had just basically become part of the landscape.
Totally unprepared. I'm still skeptical that this lawsuit will succeed. At the end of the day, it still strikes me as ridiculous on the face of it. But the Obamacare repeal that Republicans are trying to pass through Congress would have been a heavy lift. It would have been a political liability in all likelihood, and that would have been phased in and more partial compared to what would happen if the court simply threw out the law. And there's no way Republicans, even if they could come up among themselves with an ideal replacement plan, which they've never managed to do despite years of saying they're going to repeal the law, even if they could, they can't pass it through a Democratic House. So your best case scenario then is some sort of unsatisfying compromise, assuming you could come up with one. Maybe you could on paper, but in reality, it's very unlikely. And Democrats would take this into the election and say, look, they destroyed this health care law, and especially the most politically potent charge would be they've destroyed the protection for people with pre-existing conditions.
Helene, the sort of precarious nature of the Affordable Care Act, I think, has been one of the arguments against it from anywhere on the political spectrum, including from the left, that basically because the law has been under constant legal threat and been so resisted by various state governments, because the Supreme Court allowed the states to get out of the Medicaid expansion if they wished, and, you know, something like a third of the states have chosen to do that, the law has been really undermined by this political by this legal precariousness. And this case is just another example of that. On the other hand, you could say the law has been more or less operating through that environment of precariousness for a number of years now, and it seems like insurance companies and providers and such are almost getting more used to that. Sort of, you know, it's there will always be these legal challenges, but people have sort of come to just understand that the law will muddle through regardless. So I guess, how much do you worry about that, that, you know, maybe we'll still be in litigation over this stuff in 10 years?
I worry a lot about this, actually. I don't think this is any way for people to receive health care or to live, for lack of a better way to put it. I mean, this is a constant uncertainty. And as you pointed out, it's not just an uncertainty for the 20 million people who are receiving their insurance through the Affordable Care Act exchanges. It is an uncertainty for every single person in this country. The ACA at this point undergirds the entire healthcare system. And should it get taken out, we're about to find out whether our healthcare system is a Rubik's Cube, as people like to put it, or if it's my favorite childhood game, Kerplunk, where you pull out a straw and the marbles fall, and you pull out a straw and the marbles fall, and you pull out a straw and all of a sudden all the marbles fall, and that's it. Because this is really going, this has massive uncertainty for everything from how hospitals receive money to how Medicare operates to whether people with pre-existing conditions can receive insurance through work. And so on down the line. And I think this really needs to be reported a lot more. And when people write about it and talk about it, it needs to be talked about a lot more. Because I don't really think people truly understand that on either the left or the right. On the other hand, I think the people who oppose the Affordable Care Act and are really fighting it actually do. And I think there's this weird nihilistic streak in the culture at this point that really doesn't seem to care what the consequences are. And I'm not sure why that is or why anybody would support that. But I think it's a reality you can't discount at this point. It's going to be really awful should something happen to the Affordable Care Act. And it's going to be really awful for people who think they have really secure employer insurance as well.
Nick, what should we watch for with this litigation? Because my understanding is this three-judge panel has a really wide variety of options of what they can do with this case. It's not just a matter of either upholding the decision by the district court to throw out the whole law or overturning the whole thing and just ending this legal challenge completely. They could, for example, they could send it back to him and basically say, you're right, the mandate is unconstitutional, but throwing out the whole law was incorrect. Go back and do another severability analysis to try to figure out what parts of the law we can keep and what parts we can't.
Yeah, at least one of the judges on the panel seemed interested in that kind of split the baby approach. We know that big chunks of the ACA have to go, but we're not sure exactly which ones. So could you take a crack at it in the first instance? If that were to happen, the ACA's defenders could still run to the Supreme Court and say, hey, look, the Fifth Circuit just said that, you know, some substantial part, we don't exactly know how much, of the ACA is invalid, and we need you to intervene. Whether the Supreme Court takes that case, it's a little hard to say. The court is acutely aware that there's an upcoming presidential election and might prefer to keep its nose clean and to stay out of that and to wait for Judge O'Connor to issue a different severability holding before hearing the case. But if that's so, then boy, we're looking at tacking on another year or two to this litigation. And that means the uncertainty is going to extend well into the next administration. The Supreme Court also might just say, look, we need to get this resolved. We need to get it resolved sooner rather than later and choose to hear the case, you know, at the first available opportunity. It's frankly really hard to handicap.
Nick Bagley is a law professor at the University of Michigan. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Still with me are on the left, Helene Olin of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Helene Olin, what's your Tweet of the Week?
All right, it's time for some comic relief after that depressing discussion. My tweet comes from the account Jewish Food, which is, what's your most controversial Jewish food hot take? And let me explain this. All takes are controversial because the food of my people is really not very good, and we don't like to admit it. So people immediately got into arguments about all this. And when I confessed my love of jarred gefilte fish, someone else I formerly respected, and notice I say formerly, wrote in to say they agreed and added that they liked chopped liver, too, which is just unacceptable.
Rich Lowry, what's your tweet?
My tweet is from the Washington journalistic outfit, the Washington Free Beacon, and it's just a clip from Trump's press availability on Friday. Trump, colon, Pelosi, not a racist, was just a sign that we're through the looking glass now in identity politics, where Nancy Pelosi is being accused of racism or racial insensitivity by members of her own caucus, and the president of the United States is standing up for her.
My tweet of the week comes from John Noonan, who is a national security policy staffer to Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. He tweets about singer R. Kelly's arrest on federal sex trafficking charges. It's a big week for federal sex trafficking charges for famous people. Noonan tweets, "It's the remix to In Prison." I've been talking with Helene Olin of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Cardiff Garcia, host of Planet Money's The Indicator, to talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Federal Reserve. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Helene Olin, columnist at The Washington Post. When the Federal Reserve makes monetary policy, it's supposed to pursue two mandates, full employment and stable prices. The implication is that there's a trade-off, that if you let the job market get too hot, inflation will spike. But in the last decade, the Fed has taken unprecedented steps to support the economy and the job market with very easy monetary policy. They even kept short-term interest rates at zero for about a decade. And inflation hasn't spiked at all. In fact, the Fed is supposed to generate inflation of 2%, and it keeps undershooting that target. Since 2016, as the Fed has modestly raised interest rates, it has therefore drawn increasing criticism from the right and the left, saying the bank has misunderstood the relationship among interest rates, inflation, and unemployment. The basic complaint is the Fed keeps overrating how hot the job market really is and how high the risk of inflation really is, and as such, it's been raising rates when it shouldn't. At a congressional hearing this week, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez questioned Fed Chairman Jay Powell about the Fed's unemployment estimates, pointing out how the Fed has repeatedly cut its estimate of the so-called natural rate of unemployment, down below 5 and then into the low 4s, and today unemployment's even lower than that.
Unemployment has fallen about 3 full points since 2014, but inflation is no higher today than it was 5 years ago. Given these facts, do you think it's possible that the Fed's estimates of the lowest sustainable unemployment rate may have been too high?
Absolutely.
This exchange led to rare praise for AOC from Larry Kudlow, who leads the president's National Economic Council. So what does this emerging left-right consensus for easy money mean for the American economy? To discuss that, Cardiff Garcia joins us now. Cardiff is co-host of NPR's The Indicator from Planet Money. Hi, Cardiff.
Hey, Josh.
So it's not just outside lawmakers. This thinking is also gaining some purchase inside the Federal Reserve itself.
It has been gaining increasing purchase inside the Fed. And I think what we're seeing now is a willingness to newly admit, quite frankly, and as you saw from the Fed chair, that yes, that the point at which inflation might take off, right, has been sort of overestimated in the last 5 years. And what I mean by that is that there is supposed to be an unemployment rate. And if the unemployment rate dips below that point, you would expect to see higher inflation. Why? Because companies would then start having to compete with each other to hire workers. And one of the ways they compete with each other is by raising their wages. And when they raise wages, you would also expect companies to start raising the prices of the goods and services that they sell in order to offset the cost of those of paying those higher wages. But what's happened is that the unemployment rate has gone all the way down to now where it is at, I think, 3.7%. And the Federal Reserve, as recently as a few years ago, thought that actually if the unemployment rate went below about 5.5%, that inflation would start taking off. It just hasn't happened. So empirically, it's just kind of hard to deny that the Fed has kind of gotten this wrong for the last few years.
So should the Fed ever raise interest rates? I mean, usually you think about that, like at the hot part of the economic cycle, that's when the Fed should be raising rates. Aren't we in the hot part of the economic cycle right now? If this isn't the time for higher rates, do they ever need to raise rates?
I think the answer is still yes, right? I mean, the economy still can get to that point where inflation is taking off and there would be a need to raise rates. But what you heard Chair Powell say quite clearly in that testimony was that there is no real evidence that this is a very hot labor market, right? In other words, wage growth is a little bit faster than it was a couple of years ago. It's a little over 3%, but it has been much higher in the past before the financial crisis. And so we don't have, and by the way, it's been stagnant for roughly the past year or so. So it hasn't been accelerating in the last half year to a year. And so I think we're just not there yet. And the Fed keeps anticipating that we're going to get there soon, which is one of the reasons that it ended up hiking rates, I think, 8 times since the end of 2016, when maybe there wasn't a need to. And this is partly, I think, why the Fed chair has been signaling that a rate cut is coming soon.
Rich, where did all the monetary hawks go? For years, I kept hearing from conservatives who were tearing their hair out about the idea that the Fed was printing all this money, that it was artificially propping up the Obama economy, that these low interest rates were debasing the dollar and we were going to have runaway inflation. You don't hear that from anybody anymore.
Yeah, so in part, it feels right like it's the Republican policy is constantly expansionary fiscal and monetary policy for me, but not for thee. Because of the way the conservatives reacted to Fed policy during the Obama years and the way they also reacted to the deficit, which is also a concern that's way fallen off. I think part of this, you know, partisan hypocrisy might be part of it, but I think part of it is people just realized they were wrong and might have been understandable that they were wrong. The Fed's quantitative easing in the wake of the financial crisis was unprecedented. There's Republican economics sort of have built in, you know, real anti-inflation bias in part based on the memory of the 1960s and 70s when it was a major distorter of our economy and a major crimp on middle class lifestyles. So there was just a constant expectation that we'd snap back to that problem from the 70s, and we just didn't. And Donald Trump's kind of been all over map on this question as on many other policy questions. But on the whole, he's been righter than or more correct than a lot of the quote-unquote smart policy folks on the right who are ringing these alarm bells that were just mistaken during the Obama years.
Helena, I think Rich is right that there was a mixed set of motives among conservatives who were calling for hawkish policy during the Obama administration. I think that there was genuine fear of inflation, which I think is abated as inflation has not materialized. But I think it's also it sort of relates to something that Jonathan Chait calls the hack gap, that basically you have a lot of Republican economic commentators who are willing to go out there and change their views based on the political circumstances that prevail and to call for the Fed to do things that would slow down the economy when there's a Democratic president, call for things that will speed up the economy when there's a Republican president. You don't see that on the left. I mean, you see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I think, quite genuinely urging easier Fed policy because she thinks it will be better for the economy and better for individual workers. The same thing she'd be saying if a Democrat were president. I guess the thing is, do you worry that next time a Democrat is president, this whole thing's going to flip back and you're going to see these Republican voices that used to be hawkish are now dovish, they're going to be hawkish again, even if there's no good reason for them to change their view?
I absolutely agree. I mean, that the Republicans are hypocrites about this stuff is no secret at this point. I mean, they ranted about the low, you know, this stuff for years during the Obama administration, and then Trump gets into office and suddenly they flip on a dime, basically. The question really is twofold, is why do Democrats, when they're in power, embrace, you know, some of this talk, right? Why do they, you know, position themselves as, you know, we have to be the hyper-responsible people? And instead, why don't they simply, you know, sort of accepting these sort of vaguely corporate mandates and instead actually try to help people? And that becomes the issue. And that's what I think Ocasio-Cortez is trying to get at, that there was this sense that Democrats were often, you know, following the interests of business versus, you know, what would really help the mass of the population. And the mass of the population is being helped by low interest rates.
So I think, Cardiff, when you talk about how genuine are the shifts on the right on this stuff, it depends which individual people you're talking about. There are some figures associated with the Fed, like Neel Kashkari, who's the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, James Bullard, who I think seem to have really genuinely changed their views and are, you know, have have considered evidence and are more dovish than they used to be. Then you have some people like Steve Moore, who it really seems like they just, you know, they did whatever President Trump wanted them to do. The president has named two people who he wants to put on the Federal Reserve Board now, Judy Shelton and Christopher Waller. How should we think about those two people in that equation? What would they be likely to do if the president succeeds in getting them on the Fed? How will they think about this issue about how the Fed affects ordinary people?
Well, I mean, to start with Shelton, I mean, she just has been wrong up until very recently about her understanding of the economy. And she was writing in the aftermath of the Great Recession that looser fiscal and looser monetary policy risked accelerating inflation. She also has been somebody who thinks that monetary policy should go back to the gold standard, which I think sort of contrasts like the entire purpose of the Federal Reserve, which runs a fiat currency, right? She obviously changed her mind suddenly when it seemed like she was somebody that might end up on the Fed. She said weird things like Mar-a-Lago would be a good place for, you know, a Bretton Woods conference or a monetary policy conference or something like that. Just kind of strange ideas. This is clearly somebody that you would worry about, would shift back and forth in her views depending on who was the president, right? Christopher Waller is a different story. I mean, this is somebody with like a very rich intellectual background in monetary policy. Fun fact, he's actually somebody who has covered in his academic career the topic of central bank independence, stressed its importance. He even built a model essentially arguing that it was likely that a president appointing people to the Fed at the beginning of his term would start with more partisan types and then would moderate over time. President Trump, interestingly enough, has gone in the opposite direction, having appointed some very competent people at the start and then having nominated some competent people and then sprinkled in kind of the hacks and weirdos alongside them, right? So anyways, Waller is somebody who has informed the ideas of St. Louis Fed President James Bullard, who you just mentioned, somebody who's been arguing for lower rates for a couple of years now. And so I think he's a reasonable choice. He has a very conventional background. So it's sort of 50-50, right? I mean, you've got one choice that's quite reasonable, quite understandable, and you've got another one maybe less so.
Rich, it's so funny to me how the president has fumbled around for personnel here, because he has the president. I was going to say the president has a clear view, which is wrong, but the president does align with this dovish line of thinking that calls for lower rates in this circumstance. And yet the people that he has picked to try to implement that have varied wildly. You know, Herman Cain, and then you have someone like Judy Shelton, who now says that, you know, that interest rates should be cut, but who also says that we should have an inflation target of zero, which would seem to imply that you would need higher rates right now. So it seems like the president deeply desires to influence what the Fed does not seem to have had a strategy that is effective for doing that.
I think we're getting a window into a little bit what his judicial selections would look like if there weren't a major political constituency for a certain kind of judicial selection, and if there weren't a robust organization devoted to grooming and creating conservative jurists and promoting them and creating lists of them for the White House to choose from and working very closely with the White House on who actually to pick, and with Mitch McConnell involved in that. Instead, this is the president whose, you know, views as of, you know, the day before yesterday in conservative circles would have been heterodox. And then just out on his own. There's no organization for this. There's no political constituency for getting good people. So we're seeing more his natural predilections, which are all over the place. It's sort of an accident. He gets someone good, and then he likes someone who's totally unsuited for the job. So it's just this complete dog's breakfast.
Helene, how should Democrats be thinking about personnel at the Federal Reserve? Because, I mean, this is such an important area of policy that gets relatively little political attention. And it's not just Republican appointees who were pursuing the old consensus that I think a lot of people on the left and right believe meant that rates got raised too soon. I mean, it was Janet Yellen who started the campaign of rate hikes. So how should Democrats be thinking about who a Democratic president should be putting at the Fed?
Well, I think Democrats, as I said before, really need to think about this in terms of how this will help people and not necessarily just put business first. And I think that's been kind of the key here, is that there's been this fear that inflation is going to sort of rear itself up and it's going to damage business. Inflation actually, if salaries can keep up, doesn't necessarily damage people as much, right? It does, because people feel uncertain during inflation. But it actually, if you study the 70s, it actually helped a lot of people, which is something we don't really talk about very much anymore. And I think that what Democrats really need to do is they need to sort of sit down and think about what is the natural rate of unemployment? How many of these people who are, you know, not in the labor force right now would get back into the labor force if they could find work, which has, I think, been one of the things that has been causing all of this confusion over what is the natural rate of unemployment, is how many of these people are on the sidelines permanently versus they're on the sidelines because they just can't find something that they think is right for them or pays them adequately or fill in, you know, works with their childcare schedule or fill in the blank, and therefore they say they're not in the workforce. And I think these are all things the Democrats need to wrestle with.
Unfortunately, we need to leave that there. Cardiff Garcia co-hosts NPR's The Indicator from Planet Money. Thank you, Cardiff.
My pleasure.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
The women's national soccer team is an extraordinary example of sports excellence. It's not such a great example of pay discrimination. Once you take into account the smaller audience and market share for women's soccer, the pay disparity looks different. Ultimately, women's players will sustainably make more when the game gets bigger, which a women's team has certainly done more than its part to promote.
Helene Olin, what's your rant?
Permit me an insider journalism baseball rant. The Pulitzer Prizes were awarded 3 months ago, but I am still angry that the Miami Herald's Julie Brown and Emily Michaud did not receive even a runner-up nod from journalism's highest award for their extraordinary investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. They took a cold case and brought it back to life, finding and interviewing dozens of underage victims and revealing massive prosecutorial malfeasance. They did it from an ill-funded newsroom, sometimes not even filing their expenses for reimbursement. Minus their contribution, it's likely Epstein would be walking around Manhattan today. Do better, Pulitzers.
For my rant, the District of Columbia is suing Marriott hotels over resort fees. You've probably encountered these. A hotel will say your room rate is, say, $150, but then there's a resort fee of $30 on top of that that covers your use of the pool and the gym and certain other features. And that fee is mandatory. You can't say, I'm not going to the pool, I don't want to pay the resort fee. Really, the fee is just part of the room rate, but the hotel breaks it out separately so they can put a low number in big type when you look up what the rate is that misleads you. This shouldn't be allowed. It's unfair to consumers, and it's unfair to competing hotels that price honestly. For nearly a decade, states and the Federal Trade Commission have been trying to work towards some sort of solution on this and failing. It is time someone sued. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Helene Olin, Nick Bagley, and Cardiff Garcia. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.